we have to be very, very careful. What we're talking is not so much democracy, we're talking organised hypocrisy. Hard facts. Was it the best of times or was it the worst of times? Whatever your point of view, 2016 has undoubtedly been a year of seismic political and geopolitical importance. With the decision of the British people to exit the EU in June, a major brick in the wall has been removed from a European Union that has been pitched into crisis as a consequence, along with a British political class for whom crisis now appears the new normal. Meanwhile, across the Atlantic, Donald Trump's election in November confounded all predictions. Staggeringly, a billionaire businessman with no prior political experience succeeded in ending not one but two American political dynasties, Bush and Clinton, in less than a year. With the onset of Brexit and Trump, are we looking at the collapse of the Western liberal order? And is it a good thing, this collapse, or are there reasons to fear? Meanwhile, what of the outgoing president, Barack Obama? What of his legacy? The nation's first black president swept to office back in 2008 with the mantra of "Yes, we can." Two terms later, did he deliver on the soaring rhetoric that became his trademark? Or rather than "Yes, we can," has it been a case of "No, we have not"? In 2016 was also a year in which two giants of the 20th century, Muhammad Ali and Fidel Castro, departed this mortal coil. What of their legacies, and where is their like today? I'm John White, this is Hard Facts, and in this special episode, it's Back to the Future with a review of 2016. Joining me for this special episode to help pick through the seismic events of 2016, I'm delighted to be joined in the studio by two redoubtable voices within the political firmament. Former MEP Hugh Kerr sits in the red corner, and in the blue corner we have former UK ambassador to Uzbekistan, Craig Murray. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Thanks, John. I'm sure that Craig is really worried about being in the blue corner today, though.
Slightly confused. It's saltire blue.
Exactly, saltire blue. There you go. Well, obviously, Trump and Brexit belong, I think, in the same category, Hugh. And when I survey these events this year, I'm minded of Gramsci's famous admonition, "The old world is dying, the new world struggles to be born, and it is the time of monsters." Now, I said in my intro that we could be looking at the collapse of the liberal order. Do you agree with that, or is that a bit overstating the case?
I also think of another of Gramsci's famous sayings, of optimism of the will, but pessimism of the intellect, and I think we need both as well. In other words, we need to be optimistic about the good things that have happened in 2016, which is a resurgence of movements from the grassroots, which take various forms, whether it's in Greece with what happened with Syriza and, you know, has petered out a bit, whether it's in the Occupy movement, which is taking various forms, and indeed resistance developing in the US, or in Britain, you know, the fact that 600,000 people have joined the Labour Party, mainly in England, in Scotland, I don't think they're terribly relevant, shows that there is a mood for a different kind of politics on the left. But clearly, we also have to be realistic and look at what's happened on the right and the way radical populist movements on the right have moved forward and have taken various forms, and the use of divide-and-rule techniques by the ruling class, and particularly over immigration and the Brexit debate in Britain, or the use of migrants as a scapegoat in all across Europe, the rise of the new right in Europe, and so on. So all of those things are things to worry about. So 2016 has been an interesting year, and as the Chinese say, we do live in interesting times. 2017, I think, will be interesting as well, but maybe in a different form.
Interesting. Craig, I don't think anybody should mourn the collapse of the Western liberal order, if you want to put it like that. I mean, this is an order that's given us war without end abroad and has presided over obscene levels of inequality at home. The gulf between executive pay and the pay of the lowest paid workers has never been greater since the 19th century. That's a fact. We've had a generation of neoliberal economics reinforced with a generation of neoconservative geopolitics. And so I personally do not mourn the collapse of this order, but I do worry about what's taking its place, because I do see parallels with the 1930s when, under similar conditions of economic depression and dislocation, the liberal order in those days collapsed. And I'm thinking specifically of the Weimar Republic in Germany. And let's not pretend that this is good, what's happening here. We're seeing a resurgence of the far right across Europe. I contend that Brexit is its UK manifestation. and obviously Donald Trump, they have filled the space vacated by the collapse of the political centre ground. And so where do we go from here? I mean, obviously, in some aspects, Trump represents a welcome departure for, if he puts into practice his rhetoric and what he's pledged during his campaign, but he represents a welcome departure from what has gone before with this Cold War paradigm, you know, with his neoconservatism, with this idea of US unipolarity and hegemony. But he's made some very negative statements towards China, and it looks like he's looking at pitching into a trade war with China, and also the Iran deal is under threat. So, Craig, what do you think of Trump in the round? I mean, do you see any positives, or do you think it's all negative? Or, indeed, do you think it's all positive and there are very few negatives?
No, I think an awful lot of negatives with Trump. Undoubtedly, during his election campaign, he pandered to racist sentiment. There's no doubt about that. And that's something which obviously he has very much in common with Brexit and aspects of the Brexit campaign and UKIP. My own view is that the status quo had become unsustainable. I wrote a couple of years ago we were entering a revolutionary situation because the growth in disparity of wealth, you know, the increase in the wealth gap between rich and poor, the loss of status of ordinary working people, the loss of job security, the loss of trade union representation had created a situation where the majority of the population was beginning to feel alienated from the society which they lived in. What I didn't foresee was that the revolutionary situation would take a right-wing turn. And I think the very important thing to state is that hasn't happened accidentally, because the people who are in power, you know, were quite smart enough to see that this revolutionary situation was occurring, and they saw Occupy, they saw Podemos, they saw this surge of support behind Corbyn, and they took care to divert it in a right-wing direction instead. And the scapegoating of immigrants, for example, the idea that it's not the billionaires who are the cause of the lack of wealth of ordinary people, it's immigrants.
Well, they turned what was essentially a crisis of private greed into a crisis of public spending. And then they brought in the migrants, you know, there's too much pressure on public services, they're putting downward pressure on wages and so forth. So I think you're absolutely right in that. There was a concerted move to divert attention from the people who were really responsible for the economic crisis, the rich, the one so-called 1%, the banks and so forth, and focus it on the lowest paid, unemployed, you know, benefit sanctions and so forth. All these sectors of the population were demonised, with particular emphasis on migrants. I think you're absolutely right in that.
Yeah, and the corporate media has been essential to that task. And if you look at, for example, the BBC's complicity here in the UK, you had the BBC giving UKIP massive publicity for the last 7 or 8 years, long before UKIP had any kind of electoral support that would justify them being given that level of exposure. They were
Nigel Farage has been on Question Time 32 times in the past 10 years.
Almost a permanent fixture.
Sorry, just for members of an international audience, Question Time is a very popular topical debate show on BBC in the UK. Sorry, Craig, continue.
So I think you can see this agenda to focus the popular anger, and there should be anger, because not only have you got this massive growth in wealth disparity, in the United States you've even actually got the death rate increasing in industrial working class men. Where you've got in the UK, for the first time in 100 years, you've got a growth in the disparity in life expectation between rich and poor, but without an absolute decrease for the poor. In America, in the Rust Belt, you've got an actual reduction in the time people have to live.
The end of the American dream came out the other day. It was the FT, which showed that for the first time ever, you are now expect to earn less than your parents did in your working life in America if you're an ordinary working man, which is, you know, the end of the American dream. It was always onwards, upwards, get your new house and get your new car and so on.
I'm sure that's true everywhere in the Western world.
Exactly, you know, that's right. I'm sure the same is true in Britain. Yeah.
It's the end of the idea of
unending prosperity.
Unending prosperity and permanently increasing economic prosperity is just not going to happen anymore.
And so, of course, Marx predicted all this, you know, 150 years ago, you know, when you get the narrowing down of the wealth being held by a smaller and smaller group and larger amounts, and the gap between them and the masses, then it leads to that contradictions of underconsumption, of overproduction, and of crisis. And that's exactly what we're heading into. And it's, of course, taking all these political forms as well.
And the existing ruling class has no answers to this
no
crisis.
No answer at all.
So we have a period, a very dangerous period, actually, of interregnum, where, as you say, you're getting a lot of these ugly political forces are able to exploit the anger and the alienation. And touching on the end of the American dream, what was it Malcolm X said? They call it the American dream because you have to be asleep to believe it.
Exactly.
So I think it's always been founded in a myth, the American dream, isn't it? But it's been a very effective myth.
Very effective myth. And of course, in a way, what's happened in the change in the corporate media is very important as well. I was just commenting on the newspapers yesterday on the Murdoch and News International's attempt to take over Sky Television in Britain, which they tried 5 years ago. They came unstuck over phone hacking, but they've come back again in a new form and pretending it's a different takeover bid with 21st Century Fox. And of course, the influence of Fox News and the right-wing media, the jocks, shock jocks, radio stations and so on, all of that has changed in the US and in Britain, of course, over Brexit, the whole of the corporate media being directed by largely foreign-based exiles who don't pay their taxes, controlling the British press, anti-EU and pro-Brexit, is a remarkable change over the past 20 or 30 years.
The corruption is off the scale. The corruption is absolutely off the scale, isn't it? I think it's been really exposed this year, isn't it, in all sorts of ways, with the lobbyists, especially in the US electoral process. I mean, you have the unprecedented scenario, Craig, where you have the CIA at open war with the president-elect. I mean, what's driving this? I wrote recently that this is all to do with vested interests, that there's a massive ideological paradigm, a massive ideological apparatus that's been erected in service to a status quo whereby they have to have an enemy, which is Russia. They have to demonise other countries to justify budgets. You've got a network of think tanks that are ideologically driven and that are committed to this neocon narrative. Is it more than that? Or is it, you know, is it that? Obviously, there's been schisms in the past. I mean, famously, I think Nixon was at war with J. Edgar Hoover and so forth, but it was always undercover, it was always behind closed doors. But this is absolutely out in the open. It's in the press. What's going on here?
It's absolutely astonishing. And it is a question of following the money. In the new Cold War, which the Clinton side was so keen to promote, is essential for the budgets of the security agencies. The security agencies themselves are a vast industry and should be seen as an interest in that way. And, of course, the armaments industry. And we've already seen several billion wiped off the shares of producers of fighter jets in the United States because of statements Trump has made about wasting money. The armaments industry is very worried about the prospect of a new detente. And there are billions and billions and billions at stake here. And it follow the money, and you'll generally come to an
understanding.
You say
that the black budget, the so-called black budget for all the intelligence agencies is said to be over $50 billion, with the CIA getting the bulk of that. I think it's just over $14 billion. So clearly there are, they have to justify those budgets. They have to justify these resources that they get from the federal government, because if they cannot, then obviously there'll be cuts and people will be out of work. So there really, I think there's a transmission belt here between all these think tanks and all these different senators and congressmen and women and all this money that's sloshing around in Washington. And I think Trump, to his credit, has seen that, and he does seem to be wanting to do something about that. But we'll come back to that after the first break. You're listening to me, John White. I'm discussing 2016 with Hugh Kerr and Craig Murray. Don't go anywhere. Hard Facts. Welcome back to the second half of this very special episode of Hard Facts. We are discussing events, large and small, from 2016. I'm in the company of Hugh Kerr and Craig Murray. But before we get back to our discussion, we took to the streets earlier. Let's have a listen to what the public thinks. We asked, what was the biggest news story for you in 2016 and why?
Probably Trump, because a reality TV star became the leader of the free world. It's going to shake things up a bit.
Maybe Brexit? Yeah, because it kind of brought with it loads of other conversations, like, you know, the whole age demographic of people who voted, which is quite interesting.
In 2016, probably Trump's election. Probably the most influential on a global scale, I would say.
No.
Brexit, I suppose, yeah. Those are the two big ones for me, I think.
Probably Trump, then, yeah. Personally, I think that he's an idiot. That will probably lead to kind of the degradation of society and economy as we know it. And it will probably lead to a lot of troubles because he doesn't get along with a lot of world leaders.
Obviously, it's about Trump.
Why?
Well, it was all over the news everywhere. There is so much social media making fun of him. There is games made about him. It was just like the 2016... I suppose, joke that, you know, all fear turned into joke. I'm just going with what I'm told, with what I see on social media. It's been an awful year, let's be serious. It's been a terrible, terrible, terrible year.
Hibs obviously winning the Scottish Cup, eh? That's probably my biggest highlight anyway.
There you go. Ending with a flourish. I think the gentleman that said it's been a terrible, terrible, terrible year, I think that's the quote of the entire show. I don't think we could...
Apart from Hibs winning the Scottish Cup, as a Hibs supporter, I have to say that was the best comment.
Hibernian Football Club, yeah, yeah. Craig, we're talking about Trump. Now, interestingly, Julian Assange's name has popped up this year a lot because of the WikiLeaks and his role in releasing the emails that were hacked. Now, the continuing narrative in the mainstream is that Russia was involved. You were on the show a few weeks ago and you gave us an exclusive at the time. You said it came from within Washington, and Julian Assange followed that up with confirmation of that fact. What's going on here? Why are they continuing to bash Russia with this? I mean, is this going to go on? They've come out with no evidence, as far as I know, at time as we speak. The CIA have come out with no concrete evidence. These assertions have been played widely in the mainstream press. They're clearly designed to try and delegitimise the presidential elections. Where is this going to end? How does this end?
I think it will peter out. I mean, and they are trying to delegitimise the presidential elections. They're trying to undermine Trump. And they're hoping, maybe in their wildest hopes, they might be able to affect the Electoral College in some way. I think chances of that happening are very, very small. And I think in the end, it will peter out. I think these are the kind of dying kicks of the Obama. I think they'll end up looking very stupid because the truth is the leaks didn't come from Russia. So there's no way they can actually prove it. They've started to produce evidence of attempts to hack the servers out of Russia. I can give you now, I could give you, you know, within minutes, evidence of hundreds of attempts to hack my server, my website. It happens all the time. Out of Russia, out of America, server hack attempts are part of modern life. So, yeah, they can produce those, but it's nothing to do with where the leaks actually came from. They'll just feed us a load of old rubbish. But I want to expand this a little bit to say that I think one hopeful sign, in a sense, was that the WikiLeaks documents that on Clinton, which did have an effect on the American election, did have an effect on how people voted, were part of a social media effort which won, which outweighed the overwhelming power of the mainstream media in the United States election. Because with the exception of Fox, the mainstream media was almost entirely lined up behind Clinton. And that's a good thing in a sense. It may not have been used to the best purpose we would have wanted, but it shows that there is a growing power of the internet to circumvent the mainstream media and get out stories that the mainstream media don't want to be known. But there's also a threat to that, because since then, of course, we've had this fake news meme. Yeah, where governments are now talking, both in the UK and the US and probably elsewhere, of actually legislating to censor the internet so that only state-approved news
responding to the threat. They're being subverted. That's a fantastic point, because that's one of the seminal stories of 2016, is the rise in the prominence and the significance and influence of social media in the subverting the conventional mainstream narrative on all the events that are going on. And when you think about the Vietnam War, one of the major tools that people who were opposed to the war were able to use was television. This came about the advent of the mass marketing of television. Most people had a television at that point, and it wasn't censored. It wasn't embedded reporters from Vietnam. You were seeing raw pictures of US Marines burning, Vietnamese villages and so on. They had to censor that.
And that's why they learned the lessons about embedding reporters and guarding them and supervising them to make sure that in future wars, like the Falklands and Iraq and so on, that they produced exactly the kind of material you want.
So we've seen a similar process beginning with this fake news mantra
on social media. Now they fund the social media as well in the same way, with operations in Iraq and Syria and other places, to make sure they're feeding the social media with it as well. So the intelligence agencies, of course, have got smarter as well. And so, but yeah, Craig is right, there is a threat and a danger of state control. Of course, the problem is the kids are often smarter than the state, and they're going to find it very difficult to limit and to exclude all the things. In the same way that the record industry, I was involved in music policy in the European Parliament, and I said to them, unless you sort out an accessible way for the kids to get music, they'll beat you, they'll be smarter than you. And that's also true of social media. So Craig's blog is still appearing and getting 40,000 hits a day, despite the attempts to shut it down and close it down and so on. So difficult to do, but they will attempt to do it, and that's been one of the things to watch in 2017.
But the upsurge in reliance on social media for spreading the message, I think, is symptomatic of something deeper, and that's this disconnect between the so-called, you know, the existing order, the ruling class, the elite, governments and so forth, and their media acolytes, and what people are seeing with their own eyes. This alienation, this huge gap, and this is where Brexit was able to succeed, and Trump, because there's a real cynicism towards the establishment that I don't think I've ever experienced to this intensity. I think it stems from the fault in the Iraq war, where, you know, the lies that were told, all the corruption that we've seen, the fact that nobody has been held to account for that war. We held the Chilcot report, and that's another major story of 2016, with the Chilcot report, and yet the taxpayer is now going to have to foot the bill for Tony Blair's defence, where the families are bringing a civil case. Craig, I mean, this is a level of corruption. This is what they don't get. You cannot go around the world setting fire to countries and societies, sending them into the abyss of sectarian war, and just walk away and wipe their hands and say, okay, the next one. This has to end. I mean, do you think Blair will be held to account in the wake of Chilcot? Do you think there's any chance of that happening?
I think, sadly, not. In that he's protected by almost the entire political class. When the SNP called a debate and a vote on trying to hold him to account, really, it was only the SNP plus about a dozen other MPs who voted for it, and all the others, the whole Tory party, the whole Labour party, virtually.
Jeremy Corbyn abstained, I believe.
Well, Jeremy wasn't in the House. He was off at another engagement, but deliberately, yeah, exactly. No, it was a stitch up. Yeah.
No, they will always defend themselves, because, of course, it's in their interest as a political class to defend the political class. And, of course, and you're absolutely right that that's basically why Brexit happened. I mean, for some reason, somebody decided, the Electoral Commission, that the official campaign to stay in the European Union would be led by Jack Straw's son and would consist of Peter Mandelson and David Cameron and really the most detested figures in the United Kingdom. And as soon as you put those people up as representing the status quo, the establishment, you'd lost, effectively, and it's their inability to see that. The other thing is, we were talking about wealth disparity, and that's also true with MPs. The real wages have been shrinking in the UK for the last decade, and MPs' real wages have been going up consistently. And people see that members of Parliament have huge houses which in no way relate to their official income, for example. There's a cynical view that not only do they do things like take us into wars for private gain, but that they are corrupt in general. And you're right, the political class is absolutely detested. The sad thing is, of course, that neither Brexit nor Trump has got rid of a political class, because Trump's basically the same class as Clinton. And the Trumps and the Clintons, there are loads of photos from socialising.
Did you not say on the show that Donald Trump paid the Clintons to be guests at his wedding?
Yeah. They did, that's right. True. And gave
which is astonishing.
Gave contributions to Hillary's campaign to win the Senate.
He's threatening to arrest her during the debate. He's saying, you're going to be arrested.
Which then he immediately forgets as soon as he's elected. Because basically, it's been played very cleverly. The wave of anger has been played so the same...
Channeled. It's been channeled.
Yeah, exactly. So the same political class remains in power. You have a small shifting and shuffling of...
It's not the system that's at fault. It's not the institutions. It's the people. So therefore, you can keep the institutions intact. Therefore, the system continues unfettered. There you go. Now, Brexit, Hugh. David Cameron, I mean, my God, his leg, he must go down as one of the worst, even after Blair and Thatcher. I mean, not even a plan for transition should it come to pass, not even as much as a sketch on the back of an envelope. I mean, David Cameron's legacy.
They did a poll recently as saying who was the worst prime minister in Britain since the war, and Cameron came at number one, because, of course, to go out with the biggest failure, as he did, on a whim that it was a way to settle an internal argument in the Tory party by having a vote on leaving the EU. But to be ignorant of politics, which knows that when you hold a referendum on anything, it's used as an excuse by people to vote on anything else. And as Craig said, the contempt for the establishment led to people voting in a widespread way to express that contempt. Plus, of course, orchestrated by a right-wing media whose interests clearly are in conflict. I mean, Murdoch is a case in point. I spent a long time devising a directive which stopped Murdoch and Berlusconi taking over European satellite television in Europe, and that's why Murdoch hates the EU. He said, when I want something done in Britain, I go to number 10, they do as I say. He said, in Europe, I've got to speak to 28 countries, and I have no idea who's in charge. So he hates it. So that's why the media was used against it, to break up the EU, because it affects their corporate interests and class interests. But at the same time, of course, there was the dimension of race that was used as well on immigration and so on. It's a classic divide and rule
technique.
Would you
say that Rupert Murdoch and George Soros, poster boys for everything that's wrong with the status quo?
Well, George Soros, I've got more sympathy for George Soros because at least he's used some of his money to some good, even though he made a lot of it speculating against the pound.
He bought me lunch once.
Well, there you are. I had dinner with him once in Brussels.
Word, folks, we're having very important people here today.
Absolutely.
Well, we'll come up to the break. After the break, I'd like to go on to Obama's legacy, but just quickly, do you think Brexit will happen? Because we're looking at a political class that is in complete crisis, no answers. I mean, do you get the sense that they're going to try and kick it into the long grass until people forget it? I mean, that's obviously not going to happen, but they're clearly in a state of crisis, aren't they?
They don't have a clue what they're doing. I think it probably will happen, because for it not to happen would create an even bigger political crisis for them, and that would lead to all sorts of conflicts. I think it will happen. I think they'll try and make it happen. We heard that yesterday from the Chancellor, a longer transitional period, that'll be the word, that, you know, there'll be add-ons, it'll take it 5 years or 10 years and maybe a chance to change. But I think it's going to happen in some form.
And the EU, do you think, is on it? It's going to have to reform?
I think it's going to have to reform, or it's going to collapse, yeah, because the Italian banks, the Spanish banks, all of the economic basis. Basically, the EU has been good for the German economy, but bad for everybody else.
You're listening to me, John White. I'm talking to Hugh Kerr and Craig Money. This is Hard Facts. This is our review of 2016. Stay tuned. Join us after the break. Hard Facts. Welcome back to Hard Facts with me, John White, the show that gets to the heart of the matter. It certainly has been a tumultuous year in many respects. We're looking at a new president, Donald Trump, a billionaire businessman who was, I think it's fair to say, was ridiculed when he first appeared on stage at the Republican primary debates. I think there were 16 or 17 candidates. No one gave, I think everybody, every pundit thought that he would have the least chance of getting anywhere during the nomination process. And here we are. He's the president-elect. He is set to be inaugurated on January 20th. And leaving office is the man that we're going to discuss next, Barack Obama, who, as I mentioned in my introduction, swept into office, it's fair to say, in 2008. He was presented as a change candidate. He was the nation's first black president, which, given the history of slavery, a relatively recent history in the United States, was very significant symbolically. But did he deliver? I don't think he did. I think he overpromised and underdelivered, and I think that's putting it lightly. Craig, what's your analysis of Barack Obama?
I think he was deeply disappointing. It is said, and I've not seen anyone able to disprove it, that the American forces killed someone abroad on every single day of Barack Obama's presidency. And I think that's actually very likely when you look at the incidents.
Is that troops, or is that part of the drone wars, or a combination?
A combination of that. Okay, but okay. If you put all that together, yeah, there was never a day that went past when they weren't killing somebody abroad. Yeah. And I think that's very probably true. Yeah. And that says much about the disappointment, the failure to close Guantanamo, the failure to hold another pledge he made was that he would hold to account those who had instituted the torture program of the CIA. He immediately went back on that. In fact, the only person from the CIA who went to jail over torture was John Kiriakou, who was jailed for blowing the whistle on CIA torture.
And then look at Edward Snowden. Edward Snowden, for telling the truth, for revealing crimes against the US Constitution. Where is he now? He's in big bad Russia, which is a country that gave him sanctuary. Russia, I mean, this, you know, the contradictions and hypocrisy is rife when it comes to the Obama presidency, isn't it? Especially in 2016.
From my own viewpoint, it's very, very alarming that under Barack Obama, whistleblower, having been given more years of jail sentence in total than under every other American president's combined. You know, there's been this amazing...
Chelsea Manning's obviously the most prominent, yeah.
Chelsea Manning being the most prominent, but there are a number. So, very, very disappointing on civil liberties, very disappointing on foreign policy. I mean, it's an absolute farce that he was given the Nobel Peace Prize. He plainly didn't deserve that. But also, you know, a real of failure on the domestic agenda, did nothing whatsoever to change industrial policy, did nothing whatsoever on the banks and bank regulation.
He cozied up to Wall Street, didn't he? Didn't he have Tim Geithner wrote his economic? He was a Wall Street insider.
Indeed, Goldman Sachs were very influential. But then Goldman Sachs have just got major appointees to the Trump cabinet. So Goldman Sachs run the world, whoever's in power.
The new boss, same as the old boss.
Exactly. So, yeah. But Obama, yeah, I mean, he was a disappointment, Craig. But I did watch on C-SPAN the other day on Sunday when they have it on BBC News Parliament Channel, Obama's speech to the military, his one of his last speeches, and then Trump's speech to the rally. And, of course, the difference in style. Obama was cool. He knew how to read a teleprompter. He knew how to deliver a speech. He had a lot of style, but unfortunately not a lot of substance. Now, part of it, of course, was that there were a Republican majority in the Senate and the House against them. And healthcare was an improvement for about 20 million Americans who got some kind of healthcare coverage, who didn't have it before. Still a disappointment compared to the National Health Service in Britain, but at least there was some movement there. But yeah, I think overall a big disappointment. You know, certainly under-delivered.
I was in the States at the end of September for 10 days, and I used to live there, and I've been there many times, and I have to say I saw it. Huge, and I hadn't been there for 3 years, a massive upsurge in the amount of poverty and despair. I mean, the sheer number of mentally ill people who are clearly mentally ill, they've just been abandoned to their fate. The abandonment of the poor has been an absolute crime against humanity. And that took place under Obama's watch. Now, people say that he obviously, you know, because of the vagaries of the US political system, you know, the checks and balances and so forth. But even so, I mean, he didn't deliver at all, hardly. On his promise, he demoralised a lot of people. And this ties into the point about Muhammad Ali as a political figure. Isn't it something that when you have the first black president of the United States, that you have the emergence of Black Lives Matter, a new civil rights movement, in response to the sheer number of murders of unarmed black people by cops? What does that say about his legacy?
Yes, I'm afraid that having a black president didn't mean institutional racism didn't go on. And you mentioned...
He suffered racism, to be fair. He suffered a lot of racism,
he did.
I think.
Yeah, there was a lot of racist stuff against him. That partly reflected on what happened during the election campaign. And, of course, a lot of misogyny against Hillary Clinton as well. But you mentioned Malcolm X earlier on, and I was a member... When I was a young student at LSE, Malcolm's last speech before he was murdered when he went back to the States was the greatest political speech I'd ever heard in my life. Spoke for an hour to the students at LSE, and he talked about, you know, the kind of institutional racism that was centred in the state and why you needed a total revolution to change it. And I'm afraid Obama was much more radical in his style than in his substance, and in the end he was Goldman Sachs. Went on running the show under Obama, as they will go on running the show under Trump. We can be very sure of that.
Well, that segues into his foreign policy, because one of Malcolm X's great quotes is that you can't understand what's going on in Mississippi unless you understand what's going on in the Congo. There's a circular relationship between social and economic injustice at home and imperialism and war overseas. And do you think, Craig, it was a case of Obama being a good man who was corrupted by office? Do you think he went in with good intentions? Or do you think... You know, he was just a case of meet the new boss, same as the old boss. He was a careerist. He, when he becomes president, he essentially becomes CEO of a global empire. We're talking over 700 and plus military bases abroad, a massive military, you know, overwhelms every other country's military by, you know, by a huge factor. What happened to Obama in office? Was it the reality? Was it real politic? Was it opportunism? What was it?
I think he rode a wave that he saw would lead him into the White House. And I think an awful lot of his radicalism, he never really believed. It's always difficult to tell with, you know, politicians at what stage they give in to the temptations of office and temptations of a quiet life and temptations of just doing what their advisors say. But with Obama, I have a feeling the whole exercise is quite cynical. I don't really hold the he was a good man frustrated argument. He was very quiet about it. He was a good man frustrated. Yeah. He wasn't exactly, you know, kicking and screaming about the need to help.
He didn't bring people on the streets or anything like that, yeah.
I spend a lot of my time working in Africa and on African development. And weirdly enough, George W. Bush showed much more interest in African development and went to Africa more often and put more money into USAID in Africa than Obama did. Obama, strangely enough, possibly because he didn't want to take political flak about his heritage, paid very little attention to Africa at all or to development issues worldwide. Absolutely not on his agenda. And that that, I think, is another, you know, black mark against him.
Events in Syria, I think, have reached a critical stage as we speak. Aleppo is now being officially liberated. Been an eruption of what I consider to have been a disinformation campaign in the West, Western governments and their media acolytes, wherein suddenly the Syrian Arab Army, which derives its soldiers from the mosaic that is Syrian society, its multicultural, multi-religious society, are now being painted as a latter-day Waffen-SS, an army of occupation going around shooting women and children, at random. And the obverse of that, of course, is that Nusra Front and other Salafi jihadist groups whose stock and trade is sawing people's heads off, burning them alive, throwing gay people off the top of tall buildings and so forth, they're now being painted as a latter-day French resistance and partisans of Second World War repute.
And the heroic white helmets, of course.
The white helmets who were funded, who were set up by an ex-British military officer and being funded by the French government and so forth. It's all unravelling, isn't it, Hugh, in Syria? Now, this is seminal in the sense, I think, that this is the end of US hegemony in the Middle East. Russia's intervention, some people have, you know, imputed some, you know, less than noble reasons for it. I think it's been a fantastic development in the sense of saving Syria as a secular, pluralist, non-sectarian state. Give us your analysis of what's been going on, and what's been going on particularly with the Western media in this huge campaign of vilification against Syria and Russia.
Well, of course, it all began in the invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq, and British intelligence, and Craig will remember that, it was probably partial to the briefings at that time, warned the British government that if you do invade Iraq and Afghanistan, there will be blowback in the Middle East and, of course, back in Britain in terms of terrorist actions. They ignored that, and everything since then has been a crumbling of state and societies throughout the Middle East. And Syria, of course, is perhaps the most extreme example, where there are so many different factions funded by the Saudis or the Iranians or the Iraqis and the Americans and the British and so on, have led to this situation of the destruction of what was once a very important part of civilization and culture. And yes, the misinformation of the media has been quite remarkable in recent periods. 2016 has been pretty bad for Syria. Hopefully 2017 will be better, but I think there's still a lot of conflict to go. Of course, our reaction to it is, I think we've taken so far 9,000 Syrian refugees officially in Britain. Our contribution has been pretty minimal. Our contribution to the conflict, of course, has been rather larger.
Yeah, I mean, the moralism, Craig, of these politicians in the UK and throughout the West on Syria has been staggering to behold, given the role of the British ruling class in Washington, the West in general, in creating the conditions out of which this monster, ISIS, or Salafi jihadism, erupted. I've described it as an Islamic Khmer Rouge, I don't know if you'd agree with me, intent on implementing its own year zero on a secular, multicultural, multi-religious society in which minority communities can trace their presence in that part of the world back a millennia and more. You know, I consider that they still want to see Assad toppled, and they would rather see ISIS in Damascus than Assad, because they think they can deal with ISIS more than they can deal with Assad. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I think one important point to note is that all of the Western journalists, without exception, who've been filing all these stories about what's happening in East Aleppo, are filing them while sitting in a whorehouse in Dubai.
You can't go to East Aleppo to get their head chopped off.
Yeah, precisely. Because the side they are supporting would kill them, yes, as soon as they saw them, as infidels. And that, in many ways, sums up a contradiction of Western policy. Strangely enough, we had a remarkable thing a couple of weeks ago, or a week ago, when Boris Johnson told the truth, to everyone's astonishment.
We're going to come on to that. We have to come on to the Saudis. Yeah, go ahead.
When Boris Johnson said that, you know, Saudi Arabia is financing proxy wars and exporting a terrorist ideology. And of course, that's true. And the support for ISIS and al-Nusra and al-Qaeda and related groups, largely financed from Saudi Arabia, but also from Qatar and Bahrain and other Gulf states, aided and abetted by the CIA and with American and British arms supplies and Israeli arms supplies going in to them. And it's really quite extraordinary that the West has got itself in this mess, where it's precisely the same mistake they made with Osama bin Laden and Afghanistan, where they were paying and financing and funding and training Islamic extremists
using it as a proxy
to fight against the Russians. And we're doing exactly the same in Syria, where we are arming and training and financing the most extreme jihadists because we see them as fighting a proxy war against the Russians. And yet, you know, we know for certain that they're going to turn around and attack us.
Well, already have. They have in Paris, they have in Brussels, they have all over Europe and in the US. And so here's the interesting thing. When they erupt in Paris or Brussels or anywhere in the West, they're described as terrorists, and rightly so. But when they do the same kind of slaughtering in Syria, they're rebels.
Yeah, it is quite astonishing. And this whole idea, we had at the time of a debate on bombing Syria, you know, we had David Cameron talk of there being 80,000 moderates.
Oh, that was unbelievable, wasn't
rebels,
it? Rebels. Yeah. The ghost army.
These democratic pro-Western forces. And of course, they are nothing of the kind. It is absolutely transparent nonsense. And yet, the mainstream media put it out every single time. And we had all those stories from Aleppo yesterday of people being rounded up and shot and children being buried alive. And there's no sourcing of it whatsoever. There are no eyewitnesses. I'm not saying that bad things don't happen.
It's war. War is hell and there'll be atrocities. But
that, I'm not saying that either side has been absolutely pure. But the absolutely unsourced and unverified stuff that's being put out is just dreadful propaganda.
You're listening to me, John White. This is Hard Facts, and I'm discussing the events of 2016 with Hugh Kerr, former MEP and former UK ambassador to Uzbekistan, Craig Murray. Please join us after the break for more on this fascinating discussion. Hard Facts. So welcome back to Hard Facts. Before we return to our discussion on events great and small from 2016, we return to the streets to ask the public, what can we expect from 2017? Let's have a listen.
Oh, we've got a fun ride ahead of us.
I don't know, probably something equally crazy that like we can't think about at the moment, but yeah.
France are next, so that will be the next one.
Well, this year can't get any worse, so it'll be a good year.
Hopefully a lot worse than happens in 2016.
Well, with the way 2016 has gone, probably a ton more of our favourite celebrities are going to die.
2016 was, as I've said, a very tumultuous and tempestuous year. We've just been discussing events in Syria and where it's going to go from here. And Hugh, where is it going to go from here? Because I don't think anybody in their right mind could believe that Syria will return to what it was. The country has suffered enormous damage. The human cost has been huge. It will take many, many years. What's the future for the Middle East? Because a lot of people have speculated that we're looking at the end of Sykes-Picot. And Sykes-Picot 1916, which was the divvying up of the former Ottoman Empire in the Middle East and the Arab world between Britain and France. Tsarist Russia was supposed to be a beneficiary of that agreement, but of course we had something called the Russian Revolution that put pay to that. Do you think this is the end of these nation states in the Arab world? I mean, I think Syria could actually emerge from this stronger, a stronger sense of national identity, a pride in what they withstood. Whether there's a transition, there'll be some sort of transition reforms, but surely that has to be a matter for the Syrian people and the Syrian people alone.
Absolutely. I was watching Paddy Ashdown last night on Newsnight. I don't know if you saw him, Craig. And of course, Paddy was the great man put in charge of the Bosnian situation after the schisms there. And he was saying that what we need is a kind of Bosnian fix for Syria, which assures is a state which is regulated, protected, and, you know, and so on. But frankly, I don't see that coming very soon. I think, as you're right, that the Syrian people should be the people to decide what goes on in Syria, as they should have been from the beginning. And of course, we shouldn't have been fighting proxy wars as the Saudis were, or the CIA, or anybody else. But I have to say, I'm not optimistic in the short term. In the longer term, yes, there may be possibilities, but in the short term, I think there's likely to be conflict going on, if not in Aleppo, elsewhere in Syria for some time to come. And of course, a big battle's going on still in Iraq and other places around the region. So I think 2017 is going to be more conflict and not so peaceful.
Craig, you touched on Saudi Arabia. I'd like to focus on that for a moment. You're in a prime position. You have expertise in this subject. Britain's relations with the Saudis, the West in general, but let's focus on Britain because of the Boris Johnson controversy when he did tell the truth at this political conference in Rome, accused the Saudis of abusing religion for its own purposes and waging proxy wars in the region and so forth. 30% of Britain's arms exports, I believe, go to Saudi Arabia. It's Britain's biggest customer for arms. Is this purely an economic relationship? I mean, it covers the British political class. Absolute shame, does it not?
Well, it certainly does that. And the arms industry relationship is, of course, important. And you shouldn't forget that the arms industry in BAE in particular spend a lot of money sponsoring politicians.
They were the first visitors to me in the European Parliament when I became an MEP. They said, Hugh, we are a Labour company. I said, oh, I thought you were an arms maker, a missile maker. No, no, they said, we're friends of the Labour Party.
No, they spend an awful lot of money supporting politicians. Let's put it that way. So, plus which, of course, you've got the other very narrow interests which benefit from Saudi money, like the London high-end property market for extremely large properties, like London casinos, investment banks. So, but these are narrow sectional interests. I mean, the economic argument doesn't stack up, because there would definitely be dislocation if we stopped selling weapons to Saudi Arabia, for example. But if we could deter Saudi Arabia from its role in inflaming and destabilizing the entire Middle East, the global benefits economically would eventually bring benefits to the UK bigger than the narrow interest of BAE and the arms industry and a few casino owners. So it's a typical illustration of the Hobson-Lenin analysis of imperialism, where we have a foreign policy designed to benefit a specific narrow section of basically arms manufacturers and the ultra-rich, but is actually disbenefiting ordinary people and the globe in a big way. But also, we mustn't lose sight of just how stupid and complicated the situation is. In Aleppo, the Syrian army was being backed not just by Russia, but was having help from Kurdish and from Iranian-backed militias. And yet, in Iraq, the Kurdish and Iranian-backed militias, who are precisely the same people, are fighting alongside the Americans against the Shiites, whereas in Syria it's the other way around, where the Americans are fighting with the Shiites against them. And the whole thing is just such a muddle. There's no ideological coherence to it of any kind. And when we look at the future of the Middle East, how you unpick all these conflicts, which the West has just got into willy-nilly, just choosing a side for the expediency of the moment, and preferring conflict over peace. Well, the West has no interest, that I can see, in peace in the Middle East. It's shown no sign of having interest in peace in the Middle East.
Is that because they're losing their dominance in the region, that they were trying to get it back, or is it because they believe in this chaos will benefit them in terms of impossible for Russia to come in and play that role, do you think? Supposing that Russia wants, I don't think Russia wants to play that role. Russia has strong, long-standing ties with Syria. It's there at the express invitation of the legitimate Syrian government. So under the terms of international law, it's acting in accordance with international law. But is that their thinking, though, Craig, do you think, that they're worried that they're losing their grip on the region?
I think it started as a straight grab for oil resources, basically, particularly under Saddam, where they wanted to get rid of Saddam, get hold of Iraq's oil, make it available to Western companies only. In the wider region, they want to thwart Russia's attempt to build pipelines to be able to export energy through. So those are all important things. It was all about energy monopolization by the West. That didn't work. It failed quite spectacular. And then they found themselves embroiled in a number of conflicts, and they've lost sight of why they were there in the first place. They are merely trying to beat Putin on a day-to-day tactical basis with very
There's
little
no overarching strategy. Scott, has fallen to pieces. The project for a new American century, which was drawn up in response to the demise of the Soviet Union by Wolfowitz and Cheney and Richard Pell and so forth, it's hit the buffers, as they say.
It's actually a disaster. And that's where Trump comes in a sense. That's where Trump is a little bit different, because coming from a totally different background and as somebody whose interest is always the bottom line financially, he's looking at it and just saying, this is crazy. This is absolutely nuts. Why are we doing
John Pilger's documentary recently released, The Coming War on China. I don't know if you guys managed to see it. John Pilger, I think, has played a fantastic role for many, many years in revealing the high crimes and misdemeanors of these people and people in power. And he speaks truth to power, and he has done so consistently. And he's done it again with this documentary, because it was actually a very chilling warning, because we've all been focused, understandably so, on Russia. You know, the Obama administration presided over the worst relations between Washington and Moscow since at any time during the Cold War, apart from the Cuban Missile Crisis or these NATO troops. I mean, just in parenthesis, we had the ridiculous situation where we had NATO troops being deployed on Russia's border at the same time as Russian servicemen were bleeding in Syria fighting ISIS. I mean, that's among many of the contradictions, that was one of the most glaring. But in the process of focusing on that issue and that crisis in Eastern Europe and in the Middle East and so forth, we've perhaps lost sight of what's going on with China. China's economic growth has been phenomenal. Even during the worst years of the economic depression, never went below 7%. And it's now, obviously, where there's economic growth, there has to be military growth to protect its markets, its resources and so forth. There's a territorial dispute in the East and South China Seas with the US and US regional allies, Japan, South Korea, Singapore and so forth. And the US is now cozying up to, they've just recently lifted their, I think it's a 50-year arms embargo on Vietnam, after the Vietnam War. So they're obviously trying to curry alliances in that part of the world with a view to stemming China's threat or supposed threat. We had Obama's pivot to Asia, which was announced in 2000. I mean, the idea, the arrogance behind any US president saying we're going to have a pivot to Asia. Imagine the leader of China, president of China, was to say we're going to have a pivot to the US. You know what I mean? This is the upside down world we live in. So what John Pulger is saying, that there's 400 military bases surrounding China. It's a strategic noose, as he describes it. Is this something we should be really concerned about going forward into 2017?
I think it is, yeah. I watched Pulger's documentary. I thought it was excellent. And I think there is a problem. The only caveat I would have is that actually, China has a lot of money invested in the US, estimated up to 20% of the US national debt is actually earned by China in one form or another. So there's a bit of a common interest, one suspects, that for Trump presidency, looking at the bottom line and looking at China, though he's made all this noise about bringing jobs home and so on. I mean, again, I think that the reality will be that actually he won't be able to do it, and that the common economic interests that they have might actually prevent it becoming anything more than skirmishing. But of course, you know, the indication that the one China policy might be up for grabs and question, that's a little worrying to the Chinese, obviously, with the situation in Taiwan. So I think there will be that 2017, that will be a big issue. I suspect economic interests between the Chinese ruling group and the Trump Goldman Sachs boys will probably mean that we don't have a more open conflict, but it's certainly an area of concern. I don't know what Greg
thinks. Your thoughts, China.
Well, I think the great area of hope is that China isn't showing signs of expansionary or imperialist ambitions. It seems to be a power which is quite happy to be a big economic power without wanting to put military bases all over the world.
Kind of quietism, a path of quietism, yeah.
Yeah, and I don't see any particular reason to think that's going to change. I think the American policy of worldwide dominance and holding hundreds of bases on foreign soil is appalling. And I just briefly want to mention one thing which made me terribly sad in the last year, which was the British government's decision not to do anything about the Chagos Islands and the expulsion of the population of Diego Garcia in order to maintain precisely one of those anti-Chinese military bases. And I think that's a deeply shameful blot on our nation that we've seen.
One of many, yeah. Well, as we've heard, it's been a tumultuous year, no doubt, 2016. What will 2017 bring? It's been a joy to present this show. I hope you'll keep listening going forward into the new year. All that remains for me to do is wish you a happy new year, a safe new year, a fulfilling new year on behalf of everyone at Hard Facts. No matter what divides us, what unites us is far, far stronger.